Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 292, titled Power Corrupts. This is a 2.5-hour program, and it is being recorded on April 15th of the year 2001. The title, of course, alludes to the old saying that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And what this is about is the energy crisis, both in California and nationally. And we're going to be taking a look at the power industry. We're going to be taking a look at coal power. We're going to be taking a look at the petroleum industry. We're going to be taking a look at the, quote, electricity shortage, unquote, in California. And, by the way, for those people who don't think this is going to happen to them, the Bush administration, inextricably linked with the energy industry, is projecting that there's going to be a nationwide energy shortage and blackouts elsewhere as well. We should note in that context that George W. himself is an oil man. His vice president, Dick Cheney, is an oil man. Don Evans, the commerce secretary, is an oil man. Bush's number one energy advisor is Kenneth Lay, the outgoing CEO of Enron, the largest natural gas producer in the world. I would also note that the Secretary of the Treasury is Paul O'Neill, the former head of Alcoa, and the aluminum industry uses a lot of energy. The Energy Secretary himself is Spencer Abraham, who, as a United States Senator from Michigan, lobbied heavily to have pollution restrictions on the automobile industry lifted. And I would note also that the White House Chief of Staff is Andrew Carr, a former lobbyist for the automobile industry. So it should not come as any great surprise to see, quote, energy shortages, unquote. In a number of For the Record programs, including number 214, and number 236, we took a look at the, quote, oil shortage, unquote, of 1979 and 1980, and also the, quote, oil price increase and oil shortage, unquote, of the year 2000, and analyzed both in terms of deliberately manufactured crises to benefit George Bush running on the Republican ticket. There is very firm evidence that the oil crisis of 1979 and 80 was deliberately created, and again, For the Record program 214 goes into that, and we also took a look at the oil shortage, unquote, of the year 2000 in number 236. I would note that in For the Record program number 284, we took a look at the fact that the elder George Bush was working for a firm that in turn was deeply involved with Saudi Arabia, and he was talking with the king of Saudi Arabia in 2000 during the course of the campaign. We're going to begin by taking a look at someone who is the world's number one terrorist, and this might seem to be something of a departure from a discussion of the, quote, energy crisis, unquote, but in fact it's part and parcel to what we're talking about. The following article is about Osama bin Laden, the number one Wahhabi in the world and also the most sought after, or at least the most publicized, of the, quote, Middle Eastern, unquote, terrorists. The following article is from the Financial Times of London of April 14th and April 15th. This article is titled Millionaire Terrorist Fugitive, and it was co-authored by Robin Allen and Carola Hoyos, H-O-Y-O-S. Now, this article talks about Mohammed, or Osama bin Laden's father, Mohammed Awad bin Laden, in For the Record program number 186, as well as in numbers 248 and 256. We took a look at the relationship between the bin Laden family and James R. Bath and BCCI. We also took a look at this in For the Record program number 277 as well. There is a slight correction to make in that the member of the bin Laden family, the Sheikh bin Laden, involved with James R. Bath in helping to put forward the go capital, so to speak, for George Bush's Arbusto Energy, could not have been Osama bin Laden's father, but rather would have been another member, another Sheikh bin Laden from that same very, very large family, because bin Laden's father had died in a crash of a private plane in 1961, according to this article. However, this article points out a number of different things, including the fact that the bin Laden family was very large indeed, and above all else, that it was very, very close to the royal family of Saudi Arabia. And in particular, bin Laden's father was very, very close to Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, who was the founder and, for many years, the head of state of Saudi Arabia. We've spoken about ibn Saud before, and we're going to come back to him in just a minute. But reading about the relationship between Osama bin Laden's father and ibn Saud, we read, bin Laden's father, Mohammed Awad bin Laden, emigrated from southern Yemen's Hadramawat Valley in the 1920s to Saudi Arabia, where he became a close friend of the country's founder and first monarch, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, whose example he followed by taking almost as many wives as the king. Like the king, Mohammed's many children consolidated his strategic alliances through extended families. And I would note that there were many sheikhs, are many sheikhs bin Laden, but that could not have actually been his father, who was an investor with James R. Bath, although James R. Bath was the business representative for the bin Laden family in the United States. And James R. Bath put up some of the capital for Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil company, and as noted in a number of For the Record broadcasts, most recently 277, since Bath apparently had little or no money of his own at the time, that appears to have come, that capital that is, from his wealthy Saudi Arabian clients that included the bin Laden family, for whom James R. Bath was the U.S. or Texas business representative. We're going to talk now about the relationship between Ibn Saud, again a close friend of Osama bin Laden's father, and Jack Philby, a British-born fascist who in turn was the father of Kim Philby, a famous British intelligence agent who doubled on British intelligence for the former Soviet Union. And in turn, those two men's relationships, that is to say Ibn Saud and Jack Philby, with both the Third Reich and Alan Dulles. As we've looked at in a number of programs, including For the Record programs numbers 273 and most recently 186 and most recently 273, Alan Dulles was very, very close to the Bush family, and in fact it was Alan Dulles who put together the holding company, the Harriman 15, which helped to cloak the Bush family's assets that were inextricably linked with the Third Reich, including the Union Banking Corporation, a joint Bush family Thiessen family venture. Of the relationship between Alan Dulles, the Third Reich, Jack Philby, and Ibn Saud, a close friend of Osama bin Laden's, we read, Jack Philby has become, going to be reading from the book The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hard and soft cover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. Of Jack Philby, Ibn Saud, Alan Dulles, and the Third Reich, we read, Jack Philby has become an obscure footnote to the history of the Cold War, but his legacy was far from minor. He is one of the lesser-known but most influential persons in the modern history of the Middle East, the renegade British intelligence agent who plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation, and again note that he was very close to Osama bin Laden's father. Philby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Philby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of that region. The man who helped them to do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Philby while he was coordinating American intelligence gathering in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More importantly, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Alan Dulles' profits came from the same source. Alan Dulles, very close with and a business and legal associate of the Bush family. And note again that Alan Dulles was very close to Ibn Saud, who in turn was very close to Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's father, rather, and part of Osama bin Laden's family, apparently put up part of the capital that went to finance Arbusto Energy, George W. Bush's first energy company. In For the Record program number 256, I noted that the investigation into the bombing of the U.S. destroyer Cole, which killed 17 U.S. sailors, so far points in the direction of Osama bin Laden, and since that helped to discredit the Clinton administration and apparently played a role in helping to elect George W. Bush, I have asked the question about the relationship between Osama bin Laden and the Bush family and the petroleum industry. We've also talked about Osama bin Laden in For the Record program 182. Talking about Wahhabi activity in the former Soviet Union. And note that the Wahhabis are the very, very conservative sect, and it is that sect that to which Ibn Saud belonged and to which his father also belonged. Returning once again to this Financial Times of London article from April 14th and April 15th, I would note that another of Osama bin Laden's military successes apparently also helped to discredit the Clinton administration. Skipping down, one of bin Laden's earliest actions was arguably one of his most successful. U.S. prosecutors claimed that Al-Qaeda, the base, the network he co-founded in Afghanistan, allegedly to carry out terrorist attacks, trained those who ambushed and killed 18 U.S. servicemen stationed in Somalia in 1993. I would note that that ambush, as I recall, of U.S. Army Rangers, that ambush also helped to discredit the Clinton administration in the eyes of the military and the public early on. So I would note that two of Osama bin Laden's apparently most successful attacks against American personnel both helped to, both benefited from an electoral standpoint of the Bush family and the Republican Party, helping to discredit the Clinton administration and, by extension, during the 2000 campaign, Al Gore. So again, one wonders about the relationship between the bin Laden and the Bush families and also BCCI. And I've alluded to many tapes touching on these subjects. Those are available from Spitfire. More about the relationship from about Ibn Saud and more about the relationship between Ibn Saud and Jack Philby and Alan Dulles and the Third Reich, Saudi Arabia and the petroleum industry in For the Record program number 216. We've been told extensively about the, quote, energy shortage, unquote, in the United States. We're going to take a look at an article now that was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This article is by Sam Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. It's from the very, very worthwhile publication Online Journal that we've used before. Online Journal can be accessed at www.onlinejournal.com/SR reports/Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, and this particular report is titled Bush, Coal, and the Internet. Again, it's by Sam Perry. It's Dateline October 9th of the year 2000, and this alludes to a badly undercovered press conference that George W. gave on September 29th of the year 2000, in which he blamed a coming energy shortage, note this, on the Internet. Now, as I read this article, I want to note not only the fact that George W. was already forecasting an electricity shortage, unquote, and Texas-based power plants or Texas-owned power plants have unaccountably gone offline right after George W. was elected, helping to create the California energy crisis, which in turn is discrediting Gray Davis, viewed as a potential challenger to George W. in the year 2004. Note here, not only that George W. was forecasting this energy shortage in the fall of the year 2000, this electricity shortage, he was blaming it on the Internet. And as Sam Perry points out, the Internet appears to have reduced per capita energy consumption. And he points out that, generally speaking, energy consumption in the United States grew roughly equal with economic growth until the Internet age, in which it energy consumption, that is, grew at a much slower rate due to the fact, apparently, that e-communications and, to a lesser extent, e-commerce permitted people to use less energy. This article, again, is titled Bush, Coal, and the Internet. It's by Sam Perry from Online Journal. It's dated October 9th of the year 2000. This was researched for us by a member of the listening audience, and it reads as follows. In a major address on energy policy, George W. Bush offered a surprising assessment of the Internet as a heavy drain on the nation's electrical grid and a factor forcing the United States toward a costly new round of power plant construction, including more coal-fired generators and nuclear reactors. Bush's comment about the Internet as fuel guzzler flew in the face of widespread scientific opinion that the Internet and other technological advances have eased the U.S. economy's reliance on energy, not made it worse. Yet on September 29th, the Republican presidential nominee said, quote, "Today the equipment needed to power the Internet consumes 8% of all the electricity produced in the United States," unquote. Bush cited this fast-growing energy demand as a justification for drilling in new oil fields, including Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, and for increased burning of coal. Though his remarks about the Internet were remarkable, they attracted virtually no attention in the national news media. There were no questions put to the Republican nominee about his unusual view that the Internet-driven new economy was wasting rather than saving energy, nor did the press bother to find out who supplied Bush with his curious data. What Bush did not explain, and what the press did not deign to find out, was that Bush's claim about the Internet's energy use came from a study commissioned by a coal industry group that endorses the view that more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is good, not bad, for the Earth. Also not mentioned by Bush was that the coal industry's Internet study concluded that the United States must undertake a $1 trillion investment in new power plants to meet energy demands supposedly created by the Internet and other new technologies. Though Bush cited the 8% figure as fact, the estimate is vigorously challenged by many energy experts as a wild exaggeration of the Internet's energy requirements and as a gross distortion of the underlying reality that the high-tech new economy has achieved significant net savings in energy use. Bush's Internet energy figure can be traced to a 1999 study entitled "The Internet Begins with Coal," written by Mark Mills, president of Mills McCarthy and Associates Incorporated. Based on Mills' personal calculations, the study states, quote, "The electricity appetite of the equipment on the Internet has grown from essentially nothing 10 years ago to 8% of the total U.S. electricity consumption today," unquote. Mills goes on to predict that, quote, "It now seems reasonable to forecast that in the foreseeable future, certainly within two decades, the direct and indirect needs of the Internet will consume 30 to 50% of the nation's energy supply," unquote. To meet that demand, Mills says, will require a $1 trillion investment in a hard power backbone to supply electricity, unquote. Mills warns that, again quoting, "While environmentalists want to substantially reduce coal use in making electricity, there is no chance of meeting future economically driven and Internet-accelerated electricity demand without retaining and expanding the coal component," unquote. According to a summary of Mills' report published at the website www.fossilfuels.org, the Internet project grew out of an inquiry by Greening Earth Society President Fred Palmer, unquote. Mills also was listed as a scientific advisor to the Greening Earth Society, a think tank, and by the way, this is my interjection, listen to this, a think tank dedicated to the proposition that the rising level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is beneficial to the Earth, not the, quote, greenhouse, unquote, threat to the environment that many scientists see. The Greening Earth Society, however, is not a disinterested scientific body. It was established by the Western Fuels Association, a cooperative owned by seven coal-burning utilities, mostly in the West and Midwest. According to the latest annual report, the Western Fuels Association delivered 22.7 million tons of coal to member utilities in 1999. Greening Earth Society President Palmer, who commissioned the Internet study, also is Western Fuels' chief executive. For environmentalists, the implication of Bush's embrace of these coal industry projections about future electrical demands is dire. Coal is a major polluter of the land and water as well as the air. Coal is considered a principal source of greenhouse gas emissions which contribute to global warming. The Energy Information Administration of the U.S. Energy Department estimates that burning coal releases 36% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. Almost as troubling is Bush's acceptance of highly dubious and self-interested science as a basis for national policy under a Bush-Cheney administration. In terms of science, many energy experts sharply dispute Bush's claim that the Internet uses 8% of the nation's electricity and his suggestion that new technology is adding pressure to the nation's electrical grid. Analysts for the Lawrence Berkeley National Labs and the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions calculate the Internet is drawing about 1% of U.S. electricity while helping to achieve an historic shift toward energy conservation for the country. Traditionally, U.S. economic growth, as measured by the gross domestic product, has tracked almost precisely the nation's energy consumption. When the economy has grown, energy use has increased at about the same rate, a trend that has held until the Internet-dominated new economy of the past several years. Advanced technology seems to have produced substantial energy savings, these studies found. For instance, in the immediate pre-Internet era of 1993-6, the U.S. GDP grew an average of 3.2% per year, while electricity demand grew 2.9% per year, a ratio of 1.1 to 1. In contrast, the Internet era of 1997 to 2000 has averaged 4.2% economic growth per year, while averaging 2.2% annual growth in electricity demand, a ratio of 1.9 to 1. These figures indicate that the economy achieved a near doubling of efficiency in terms of electricity use in the Internet era than in the pre-Internet period. What's more, this analysis does not account for the fuel saved by people who now do their reading, shopping, and communicating online rather than traveling to the neighborhood library or local mall or sending regular mail through the postal service. Factoring in other types of energy, such as gasoline, the pre-Internet period of 1993-6 saw a 2.3% increase in total energy demand, while the 1997-2000 Internet period saw energy demand increase only 1% per year. All this while, Americans were increasingly driving more fuel-inefficient sports utility vehicles, spending more time in traffic, and using more home heating and cooling due to the extreme weather patterns of 1998 and 1999. These figures contradict the assumptions underlying Governor Bush's energy policy address. Beyond that, Bush's acceptance of a coal industry finance study as the foundation for U.S. government policy suggests an energy agenda during a Bush-Cheney administration tilting toward segments of the business community most opposed to environmental protections. The Western Fuels Association, which commissioned the Internet study relied upon by Bush, advocates more coal exploration, coal mining, and coal burning. In its 2000 annual report, Western Fuels condemned the anti-coal activities, unquote, of the Clinton-Gore administration. The report also criticized efforts to address the problem of global warming through the international agreement reached in Kyoto, Japan, aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Reflecting the association's hostility toward public concern about global warming, the Western Fuels annual report contains a page showing a picture of three monkeys, one each covering his eyes, his ears, and his mouth with the caption, "Are Americans ready to be told the truth?" Unquote. That truth, according to the association's Greening Earth Society, is that increased levels of carbon dioxide help the environment by providing sustenance for plant growth. In a report entitled The CO2 Issue, Greening Earth paints a rosy picture of greenhouse gases. Quote, "Evidence of very modest nighttime winter warming, robust plant growth, rejuvenating forests, and ample harvests abounds," unquote. While scientists can't forecast with precision the climate impact of global warming caused by increased levels of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, there is widespread agreement that sudden and drastic change would have a devastating impact on the Earth's environment. From rising sea levels to sudden changes in habitats for wildlife to more extreme weather patterns, droughts in some places, floods in others, the warning signs are clear. A recent report by the World Wildlife Fund and the David Suzuki Foundation concluded that one-third of the world's habitats will be altered by global warming in the new century. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was published in 1988 jointly by the United Nations Environment Program and the World Meteorological Organization for the purpose of assessing information related to global warming, has warned that there is already a discernible impact on the Earth's climate. On November 2, 1999, Robert Watson, the panel's chairman, said, quote, "It is not a question of whether the Earth's climate will change, but rather when, where, and by how much. It is undisputed that the last decade has been the warmest this century, indeed the warmest for hundreds of years, and many parts of the world have suffered major heat waves, floods, droughts, and extreme weather events leading to significant economic losses and loss of life." Quote, "While individual events cannot be directly linked to human-induced climate change, the frequency and magnitude of these types of events are expected to increase in a warmer world," unquote. Despite the warnings from the world scientific community, Governor Bush has chosen to listen to the naysayers and downplay the threats of global warming. His campaign simply has called for more research into the causes and impact of global warming, unquote, while promoting only modest initiatives to develop alternative energy sources and energy efficiency. While his close ties to the oil industry have been well documented, Bush now appears to have lent his ear to the coal industry too. Given the source of his information, as flawed and self-interested as it is, George W. Bush as president could be expected to support major new investments in the two century-old energy sources of coal, oil, and other fossil fuels. Now, bear in mind, this article was written on October 9th of the year 2000. Events have borne out that forecast to the nth degree. And I would also note that yet another indication of George Bush's partiality to coal as well as oil was contained in a remarkable article that comprised For the Record program number 281. This article was authored by Julie Reynolds and researched by Victor Almazan and Leonor Rojo. It's from El Andar magazine of the fall of 2000. That's volume 11. Number 3, the article is titled Los Amigos de Bush, The Shady Ties of George W. Bush's Latino Friends, and there's discussion in this article of some Latin friends of George Bush, including Ernesto Ancira Jr. Now, as we looked at in For the Record 281, Ancira was not only one of the principal figures involved with NAFTA, his milieu was deeply involved with drug trafficking, and his relatives in Mexico were heavily involved with the Mexican energy industry, and a joint Ancira-Bush project was a Carbon 2 coal-fired power plant in Texas, which turned out to be a disaster. We read of this as follows, speaking of the Ancira's. "Almost immediately, Governor Bush had to tackle a problem presented by Ernesto's young cousins from Mexico. The Ancira's had teamed up with an old school chum, pharmaceutical heir Xavier Autry, during President Salinas' privatization free-for-all of the late 1980s. The A-Kids maneuvered $6 million of other people's money into billions, buying up mining and energy companies as well as Mexico's largest steel company, Altos Hornos de Mexico, or AHMSA. Soon, their companies were accused of being fronts for the drug trade and were described as such by analyst R.C. Whalen at a 1993 U.S. congressional hearing. Together with a secretive binational strip mining operation called Dos Repúblicas, the Ancira's tried to get a Tex-Mex energy deal going by revamping a decrepit coal-burning power plant on the border named Carbon 2. They convinced the World Bank, Citibank, and Southern California Edison to invest over $250 million in the project. It was a disaster." By the way, it was not only polluting, but it was a disaster. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 292, Power Corrupts. We're going to continue with this discussion inside two. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.